propaganda. The truth out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert here by myself tonight as we present a special PID Radio. As you know, Sharon and I have decided to put PID Radio on hiatus, and it will take a very special occasion to bring us out of retirement, as it were. And we have a special occasion for you tonight. A very special interview. Sharon would like to be here tonight, but she's battling a sinus headache. And I'll tell you why, in her own words, she really wanted to be here tonight. She reviewed this book that we'll be discussing over the next hour, and called it a deciphering of Isaac Newton's greatest discovery, none other than the unified field theory of Bible prophecy. The author is David Flynn. The book is Temple at the Center of Time, Newton's Bible Codex, finally deciphered in the year 2012. David, it's really good to have you back on PID Radio.
Thanks, Derek, and thanks, Sharon, too, for the great article she wrote for me. I'd used it, as I was saying, maybe a couple times now already. But.
Well, she doesn't impress easily. I've known her for over 10 years, and she's a very picky reader because she's such a good writer. And she doesn't heap praise where it isn't deserved. But she gave your book a 5-star review, and I can tell you for a fact that she's read it through three times.
I'm very flattered.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really a surprise, I guess, because we've talked before about your interpretation of the occult significance of the 1947 Roswell crash. We've read your book, Cydonia, The Secret Chronicles of Mars, and Temple at the Center of Time just really, if I can say so, surpasses them all. Now, I've read just the first chapter and a couple of articles that have been shared by Tom Horn and have headlined at WorldNet Daily above the masthead for the last 3 days. And I think as of today, according to Tom Horn, the book is already pushed now into the top 50 at Amazon.com, and it isn't back from the printer yet.
Yeah, you always love to see something like that happen in your lifetime at least once. And I can't wait till it actually comes out.
Well, and here's the wonderful thing, David, because it's one thing to do it when you're peddling a lie like Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, certainly.
But Temple at the Center of Time, Isaac Newton, the guy who we credit with connecting, you know, an apple hitting him on the head with gravity, a man of science, a man of letters, learning, and yet he's the key, you argue, to unlocking Bible prophecy. How can that be?
Well, most people don't realize that more than 2/3 of his works that haven't been published dealt directly with prophecy. And
really?
And usually from the backdrop of two prophets mainly that bridge, I think, all prophecy. And this is what he said too, that they sort of bridged every prophecy that could be, and especially addressed the second coming of Christ, and that was Daniel and St. John. In fact, the only book that was ever published of his dealing with prophecy was called Observations on the Prophecies of Daniel and St. John. And I think that was – I've actually seen a book, first edition from 1773 for $3,000 on online, and I was really tempted to buy it, but that would be completely ridiculous of me to do at this point. But you can get an 1800s one for maybe $500. But that book details what Isaac Newton believed about Daniel's visions for the future, how exacting they were, and how they were always defined within the backdrop of the Temple of Jerusalem. And he brings out this in his examination of Revelation. He says, every single vision that John has when it comes to the second coming was within the backdrop of the temple. And he says it's equally valid to talk about Solomon's temple, the first, or Zerubbabel's temple, the second, and then later, you know, Herod the Great had built it up, the second temple. And then he also talks about Ezekiel's temple. And he spent an intense amount of time trying to figure out its dimensions. And that baffled me. I thought, well, wait, you know, okay, you have at face value the prophecies, you have the chronology you have in the prophecies. But here, Newton is taking this route in the middle of his prophetic work and then focusing on dimensions of the temple. And then I encountered it again in his Chronologies of Ancient Kingdoms, where he talks about the Assyrians, he talks about the Babylonians, and then he talks about the temple. And then and he actually gives a description, and he actually has plates made of in his own hand of the drawings of the temple, trying to map out exactly proportionally how everything was laid out. And he spent a long time trying to figure out the dimension exactly of the sacred cubit within his units of a linear measure, which would be the British inch. And then he goes on after that, talk about Persia and Media and Greece and Rome and on forward. And this is in a book of Chronology of Kingdoms. Right smack in the middle of it is an architectural treatise, you know, a blueprint. And what it says to me, what it said to me at the time was, you really must think that the dimensions of this thing have something to do with time. And if you look at etymologically, if you actually look at the name for temple itself, it actually is related in Latin to the word time, the temporal. The whole idea of the temple for the Ark of the Covenant was this idea that God had met Moses and the tribes of Israel at this place on the mercy seat of this Ark, this golden box that was made while Moses and the Israelites were in the Exodus in Egypt, from Egypt. It led them. It was like a navigating beacon. The presence of God actually touched that mercy seat. And because it was associated with the eternal God, the one that doesn't exist except outside of time, that is in control of time, is a master of time, omniscient, omnipresent, you know, he was in that one point where he met on the mercy seat, connecting our timeliness with infinity. And so the idea of putting a temple, or making a temple to put this Ark of the Covenant in, suggests to Newton, and I found later that he would actually write something to this degree, to this effect, that time and space had met there, eternity, because God himself is meeting there as an eternal being outside of time and space. And it gets into some sort of esoteric, and it's really difficult to try to explain it and attach words using the human agency, but the numbers speak, and Newton realized that. That's where it all took off.
Numbers, as you pointed out in interviews with us before, are a constant. I mean, there's a reason that when we put Voyager up into space, it wasn't pi. The formula for pi included, or pi was included on the plate that was sent along with Voyager, because it's assumed that if you can calculate pi and that you must be a sentient species, something that would transcend any possible language barrier, a universal constant. So is that the reason that Newton was so fascinated with the specific dimensions and and you mentioned a unit of measure called a sacred cubit. Was that why he was so interested in those numbers?
This is exactly where he launches into this study, because the sacred cubit was what he believed actually contained somehow a proportion of the dimension of the Earth itself. And I went through as much as I could of his work on gravity and tried to figure out exactly what he thought, how many miles there were to a degree of the Earth's surface, and then how much flattening at the poles he figured. He actually wrote a book on it's called A Dissertation on the Sacred Cubit and the Pyramid at Giza.
Really?
Where he actually brought back, I think it was a man named Greaves who went there and measured the pyramid, and he suspected that the pyramid would be a proportion of the Earth's diameter, which it actually turns out that it is. But the thing is, to try to figure out what the sacred cubit had with the dimensions of the Earth, I ran into some incredible connections things that I couldn't believe existed until I did the math over and over and over and over again. And the thing is that they're very simple equations. And this is something that came out of Flanders Petrie's work. He was a metrologist, I guess, somebody who studies measurement. Mm-hmm. In his book, Inductive Metrology, he wrote about what the sacred qubit was, having taken hundreds of measurements over all of the Middle East.
Well, yes, he was one of the most influential of the Egyptologists, a man whose work really set the tone and set the bar for scientific evaluation of the ancient sites in Egypt and the Middle East.
Yeah, yeah, he'd written the book on metrology, but this is after Newton, of course, mm-hmm. and Newton had said that the sacred qubit was, when he compares it to the British inch, either 25.3 British inches or 25.6. He kind of moves back and forth between it. And then he finally gets pinned down in some of the in his work on the temple, which is all in Latin, and I had to go through it with a fine-tooth comb, to find out that he actually pinned down the actual distance of the sacred qubit as opposed to the secular qubit, which was 21.6 to 25.20 inches. And I'm not sure. It's pretty close to the English inch, the American inch, and the British inch, two different things, by just about the slightest, like a millimeter. Mm-hmm. But it's still very – it's just the, exacting tolerances. And the thing was that number, 25.20, actually fits into some really wide schemes of numbers. For the most obvious one would be there were 7 days of creation. And we're talking about cycles of a day. It would be like a circuit of the sun. Well, as it appears to go around the earth. That's 360, if you're using the 360-degree system, times mm-hmm. 7, which is 2,520.
Okay.
Now, there's a number again, only you in the sacred qubit, you're seeing the fractal. That stood out. I started playing around with the number 2,520 because I realized that when Babylon fell and the writing on the wall occurred, mm-hmm. and I've looked at this in Strong's Concordance, he actually comes out and says that the writing on the wall, Mina, Mina, Tekel, Parsin, that actually happened when Belshazzar was having his big party, and this hand, this body, disembodied hand, wrote on the wall these words. They equal the number 2,520. They're actually monetary units.
Equal how?
Because a gera is the smallest unit of measurement used in Babylon at the time. It was like a penny, basically. Mm-hmm. And you have mina being 1,000 geras, so 2 minas is 2,000. Mm-hmm. And then you have Peresh, which would be cutting a mina in half, which would be 500.
Okay.
And Tekel, which is 20. So altogether, you actually have that number.
Many,
2,520.
Wow. Okay.
So I'm thinking, I'm seeing this. This is in Daniel. Newton read Greek, Hebrew, Aramaic, Latin, of course, English. And he actually knew people who were the first people to translate the Jewish texts into Latin for the first time. While he was in Cambridge, and he was able to hang out with these people who were translating texts of Maimonides, some of the greatest Jewish sages of antiquity, and he was finding these things out through them. Also, because he could read Greek and Hebrew and Latin, he was able to pick through the Bible in a way that only is possible for people like me who don't have these formal educations and, can spend all their time working like this.
Right, yes. A guy like Mike Heiser, but with a science bent degree as well.
Well, so to make the long story short, you take the universal constant pi, mm-hmm. you take the number 2,520, and you multiply them, and you get the mean diameter of the Earth. You actually get the dimension of our Earth as an average. And if you, of course, multiply it again times pi, which the number for the diameter, the mean diameter of the Earth is 7,916 statute miles. And that opens up a huge can of worms there, because if we're talking about statue miles, they were developed around the 1500s by the statue of Queen Elizabeth and her influence with Mercator and John Dee, who was her cult advisor. Mm-hmm. But 7,916 statue miles is the average diameter of the Earth. And multiply that again times pi, and you get the average circumference of the Earth. So embedded in this sacred number of 2520 is the dimensions of the Earth. And then, which really blew my mind, and it's a little bit more complicated process, but if you take 2520 times pi, of course you get 7916, which is the average diameter of the Earth. Multiply that average diameter of the Earth times 360, you get this really long number, 2,850,052. But if you divide that long number by the number of feet in a mile, 5,280, mm-hmm. you get 539, the fall of Babylon.
539 BC.
Yeah. So I started thinking there's really something going on here, because these constants repeat themselves. You can see it in the sacred numbers, and then you plug one constant into it, like pi, or like, and I don't know if you can actually identify it as a constant, 19.47, but that's it fits into a repetitive theme throughout Revelation, and that is third, the motif of the third, mm-hmm. and Newton knows that. But
1947, of course, we talked about this when we discussed the Roswell event. What is 19.47 degrees? Is the angle of the? There's some number there that relates.
It's almost like a three dimensional way of expressing a third, whereas like 33 mm-hmm. And of 100 would be arithmetic, or you could actually draw a pie graph and demonstrate it that way. A three dimensional representation of a third would be by putting the most simple platonic solid. Four-sided tetrahedron, mm-hmm. the least amount of sides you can have in a solid object, inside the most complex object we know of, which is a sphere, an undefinable number of sides, of which pi actually, points out, because mm-hmm. pi is actually trying to define this, the size of a circle, which it becomes transcendental. It never ends. The decimal places never end.
Right.
You superimpose those two platonic solids together, the highest and the lowest. And let's say if you're using, a 360-degree system to measure latitude on a sphere, so you have an axis, so it's got to be a spinning sphere. Mm-hmm. It gets a little bit complicated. If you have one of those points of the tetrahedrons touching either the north or the south pole, the other three will touch 19.47 latitude.
So in other words, to put it into simple terms for us non-mathematicians, if you put a pyramid with equal sides inside a globe, and one point is at the pole.
The perfectly into three places. If you're looking down from the north,
right,
you'll see it split perfectly into three.
Yeah, and the three base points are going to touch at 19.47. So again, you got so that's where that number comes from. Just in case people are thinking he's just pulling this number out of thin air, there's a reason for using 19.47.
And in tetrahedral geometry, it's been found that. You can actually predict the outwelling of energy on planets at that latitude. And then the sun, most of the sunspots occur at that latitude, north and south of its equator. It has something to do with spin. There's something going on there. But that's just an example of a universal constant that seems to show up in the Bible, and especially in Daniel, and especially in the Revelation. So I thought, if Newton's looking at the internal geometry of the temple and expecting it somehow to explain time and prophecy. I wonder, he didn't end up saying that he found any answers, but by inserting the temple's architecture in the middle of a book about chronology that he wrote, I thought, what would happen if I extended a line of measure using conventional, because actually finding the number of feet in a mile using 2520 and pi, just using, playing around with those numbers together. Mm-hmm. Actually finding that number of our modern standard for miles, I thought there's a connection. Somehow a connection was made. Let's see what happens. So I went to Google Earth. I measured from the Temple Mount where I believe the actual foundation stone is for the original temple. And I moved it to ancient Babylon. And I found that it was at 539 statue miles, which is exactly when Babylon fell. It was probably the most important point of Babylon's dealing with Israel. They had taken many exiles out of Israel, especially in Judah, at around 586 BC. And Ezekiel was actually exiled to a place called Nippur in Babylonia.
Really?
And he was prophesying against Jerusalem and saying, you're going to be destroyed. You know, and he was at a place called Nippur, and he'd actually seen visions, like the wheels he saw, the cherubim he saw. That was at the Kabar Canal. And you can actually find ancient Nippur, which is in Iraq now. Mm-hmm. And he predicted the fall of Jerusalem, and that's where he was predicting it, in Nippur, Iraq. And Jerusalem fell in 587 BC. Mm-hmm. So measuring the lines from Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, to the center of Nippur, actually to that little channel that you can actually see with the satellite images, an ancient canal that runs right by Nippur, where the Chebor Canal is. Now it's like maybe half a mile away from the town. 587 statue miles away. So it actually is exactly the date that Jerusalem fell, according to Ezekiel, who was standing right there in Nippur prophesying against Jerusalem. Huh. And so that it led to more and more. I found the Battle of Issus, where Alexander the Great came down to the Gulf of Issus with his generals to meet Darius the Persian. And that was in 333 BC. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that it's 333 statute miles away from Jerusalem, where the battle, where the actual pass where Alexander's army was looking at Darius's army, and they decided, to turn around and actually go into battle because Darius outflanked him around these mountains along the side of the coast. Right when Alexander's turning around, you can put your point right where the battle was actually engaged. Mm-hmm. That's 333 statue miles away.
Oh, my.
So that's when Persia fell, basically, to Greece, and the new empire took over. And, of course, the next year, Alexander went in to Jerusalem. Josephus actually says that Alexander sacrificed in the temple of Jerusalem as a sort of a friend. And that's a really weird story, too, which isn't really that closely related, but there's a lot of supernatural events and providence happening, divine providence happening during those times. Mm-hmm. So I really couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I could reproduce these things over and over again. So I started thinking about, okay, let's look more into modern times. And what is the most amazing prophetic event in modern times? And that is the rebirth of Israel.
Yeah.
In 1948. And I thought, well, where can you measure that from the temple? I mean, here Newton has suggested these things. He suggested them a number of times in a lot of different ways, looking at these diagrams that he had put. But when he was writing about the observations of the prophecies of Daniel, St. John, he actually said that according to these prophecies, the nation of Israel would have to be reborn. Hmm. Because in his time, of course, there were no Jews. There was the middle of this diaspora.
It seemed almost unthinkable, I would imagine, in 1660s and 1670s, when Newton was writing.
Yeah, he had no idea, and he says the manner, it may be another nation helps them. And while he's writing this, he's in the Tower of London, and he's in England, and he's saying, the manner I don't understand. He was almost 80 when he's writing these things, but let time be the interpreter. So, well, he actually made a prediction of the rebirth of Israel. And in fact, it was actually England that was the last empire to really rule over Palestine. Mm-hmm. Until 1948, when Israel was declared a sovereign nation for the Jews, the people of the scattered tribes of Israel. And so the capital is London. And so you measure to the actual center part of ancient London. Actually, it was called the Square Mile, where the ancient Roman London was. And there's actually a stone, mm-hmm, called London Stone, it's been moved a couple of times, but I looked into, you know, where it was, and it was in the middle of Cannon Street at one time, and it's pretty easy to figure out exactly where it was in the center of these old maps. So you find Cannon Street, and you can find where the stone is, and you extend your line from there to the foundation stone on the Temple Mount, where the covenant may have been.
Let me guess, 1,948 statute miles?
Yeah. In this case, and this is what's a strange thing, every time I find dates in our Christian era, mm-hmm. AD, you end up with nautical miles.
Miles instead of statute.
Yeah. Every time you look at a date in BC before Christ, they're in statute miles. I don't know what's going on there, but that's how it works. There's also anomalistic dates. There's also anomalistic numbers. For example, modern numbers that you're looking at current events. And one of the most intriguing ones, I think, now is the conflict in South Ossetia, mm-hmm. Republic of Georgia, Thrasia, and us, and Israel, because Israel's been training Georgia and backing them up with
military advisors, yes.
Yeah. And that occurred on the August 8th, 2008, mm-hmm. or 888. And I was looking at this a little bit closer, and I thought, wow, you know, there's got to be something to this, because I know that Jesus in Greek equals 808. If the Greek letters that spell Jesus actually are used for numbers too, and this equals 888. Our nation founded supposedly 1776, 4th of mm-hmm. July, which really wasn't Declaration of Independence, really wasn't signed then, but anyway, 1776 is that day, that year, where we decided America's America. That's 888 twice. So it would make sense that there's something going on there, at least in the illuminated circles, at least in this like sort of esoteric, higher knowledge sort of realm.
And we just thought it was the Olympics.
Name. Yeah. Well, if you think about the Olympics too, I mean, that's a very illuminated sort of idea that Olympian gods were giving tribute to, especially Apollo, god of light.
Right.
I mean, that's really focusing on that motif of illumination. Mm-hmm. So 888. I thought, what the heck? Let's just measure that distance from the Temple Mount to where the Russians actually crossed the border into South Ossetia. It's 888. Actually, to the tunnel that actually goes through the border from North Ossetia to South Ossetia, where the Russians had actually come in.
888.
I don't know what they invaded or the Georgians invaded at South Ossetia. It's hard to tell because they changed, you know, the story so much. You can't tell.
Sure.
Well, this leads into, you know, looking closer at what was going on there. The Georgians actually have a flag that's the same exact pattern as what was used in the Kingdom of Jerusalem when the Knights Templars were declared an actual official order by the Patriarch there during the Crusades in 1120, 888 years ago. So the Knights Templar, the end-all, be-all of illuminated societies, you know, to begin with, the ones that pretty much began what you can say like the Skull and Bone Society, mm-hmm. but basically they're the ones that started the first sort of European currency. They started the idea of a one sort of monetary value to use ubiquitously across Europe. They're the guys that 888 celebrates. Interestingly enough, then you also have, on the other hand, Jesus' name equals 888. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, you have all this stuff that just kind of falls out in this incredible cascade of relevance, and then at the same time raises like, you know, 50 million more questions. But it all goes back again to this idea of the connection with Jerusalem, a focus about Jerusalem, this idea of reenacting something that already happened. Because there's even stories of the Georgians during the Crusades, especially when they were the great thorn in Islam's side during the Crusades, a guy, believe it or not, named King David in Georgia, mm-hmm. actually kicked all of the Muslims out in 1120 AD, which is 888 years ago, and began to actually start raiding and coordinating raids with the Crusaders in Palestine to the point where the Muslims actually view Georgia a greater threat than the Crusaders down in Palestine itself.
That's interesting.
So there's a lot to be said for this. And I'm getting a little bit off track, because going back to Newton, you know, this is what I actually started figuring out. If it's going to show so clearly the relationship of nations and Jerusalem and what those nations did to Jerusalem and when they did it, and then proportioned linearly their distance from Jerusalem would actually pinpoint when the actual event occurred, then you have a barometer of history. You have this clock that actually can tell you, you wind it back, you actually see when these events occurred, which would make a lot of sense if you think if the creator, the author of time itself, actually has said, I will dwell on this one place on the planet. This will be my perpetual place. Actually, using the word perpetual implies that it would be an eternal sort of thing. And eternity speaks of this idea of timelessness. So everything else around it somehow has this weird resonance in time related to that point. And so you can see how hard it is to kind of come up with words that actually attend to this.
Right, because because mind-blowing doesn't begin to describe it. Our brains are not used to thinking in terms of this, but as Christians, certainly, I mean, it's the whole centerpiece of our faith. I mean, Jesus Christ himself was the, his birth date or purported birth date is the date from which we mark all of these years and seasons and so forth. And he was the interface between the divine and the, I don't know if you want to use the word profane, but you know, the supernatural and the natural worlds. And
yeah,
so it would make sense.
You've actually hit the nail on the head. That is exactly how this thing works. Because if it didn't fit on the era that we're on, the Christian calendar, the one that actually declares that Christ manifested, our God manifested, the creator of everything manifested him on the earth in the flesh, then none of these dates would work as they are related to a temple, which is actually, by Christ's own words, used as a metaphor for himself, a symbol for himself and his body itself. So that's the key. That's how this whole thing works.
Hence the temple at the center of time.
Yeah.
Now looking forward, and I just want to give people a little more of a taste of what they can expect in the book, Temple at the Center of Time. You mention the year 2012 in the subtitle, Newton's Bible Codex Finally Deciphered in the year 2012. So not only have you just sidetracking for a moment, can you imagine what Isaac Newton would have come up with if he'd had access to Google Earth?
Or you had the internet,
right?
Or computers.
Sure. It's incredible what these guys, you know, hundreds of years ago were able to do with, you know, quill pens and parchment. The title of the book implies that you are looking ahead at something coming in the year 2012. What do you think the temple is pointing to, and how did you get there?
Well, in a short way to say it, when in context Jesus uses the temple to refer to his body, he was saying, destroy this temple in 3 days, and I'll raise it up again. And, of course, the people there, the Pharisees and Sadducees, said, this temple is 40 years in the making, and you're going to raise it up in 3 days? What are you talking about? Well, of course, he's talking about his death and resurrection. So when you look at the future, the biggest event that we can possibly imagine would be resurrection of human beings because of what Christ did at his resurrection, at his death and resurrection, actually making it possible for humans to become immortal, to become part of the sons, the heirs of Christ. That whole idea that Paul talks about over and over again, you know, becoming, you know, sons and daughters, actually literal heirs to God himself, and Christ being the life, the author of life, and also, you know, the existent life that existed, the life that has existed that causes everything to have being. He existed from eternity, but then from us to have to be somehow removed from it by sin, removed from him by sin, and actually then reconciled to him again through what he did on the cross. Well, the one idea then that finishes that whole work then is the resurrection of the rest of his Christ body, which a lot of people forget. If Christ rose from the dead when he was 33, according to the calendar, the Gregorian calendar, and there's proof that he began his ministry at 30, according to the Torah, and according to what Luke says, his age was around 30 when he was baptized. Then at 33, when he died and resurrected, there's actually a really big point to that. Geographically, he was born at the latitude, which would be pi times 10. Exactly.
Hmm.
If you look at the minutes and seconds, 31, 4, 1, 5, 6, something like that. So you're looking at the number pi at Bethlehem, especially in the outskirts of Bethlehem. You know, you can go to the Church of Nativity, and it's just a little bit higher. But it said he was born in a stable in the outskirts of the city, and that's where pi is times 10. Then, when you want to find the locus of his ministry, where he did most of his talking and his miracles, it's in a place called Galilee, which actually means a circuit. And if you look at it geographically on Israel, it's right above where Jerusalem is, and the Sea of Galilee is about in the center of it. Mm-hmm. Geographically, it actually looks like a circle. And in fact, the latitude 33 cuts through Galilee. And Jesus was in Capernaum, and he did most of his miracles. In fact, he had 33 great miracles are actually ascribed to him while he was in Galilee. And I think there's some Weisenheimers in antiquity who've actually picked up on this without really knowing what the situation was and what it actually means symbolically 33 over and over again in his own ministry, because then you see later in Revelation a third of things
mm-hmm.
being judged, and a third of the angels in angelology they talk about the third of the angels are rebellious. That comes from mainly Revelation 12, where it talks about the dragon throwing the stars, mm-hmm. a third of the stars of heaven to the earth. Well, what's this thing with a third? Well, if you believe in the Trinity, and it's about as simple as it can get this way.
Sure.
If you believe in the Trinity, and this is a strange thing, Newton was a Unitarian. In fact, he was terrified of being found out to have been a Unitarian.
Really?
And that's probably why most of his religious works were never published, because he just felt like too big of a hypocrite, saying, well, I've seen other people go to the stake, you know, and to the gallows for this. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't going to be able to do that. I mean, he was hired in – he was actually the warden of the actual – the mint of the Royal Mint of London. He couldn't, you know, come out and say, oh, I don't believe in the Trinity.
Well, he lived in dangerous times for people who held beliefs that were out of the mainstream. Not only, of course, is the King of England the head of the Church of England, but he came of age his younger years, if I remember correctly. He entered school in the 1660s. And that was right after Oliver Cromwell in the Commonwealth of England, when the Puritans had control of the government. And, of course, they were pretty severe about what they believed, too. So,
yeah, and he just really mind his P's and Q's for that point in time.
Yeah.
And he preferred to keep all his research to himself. And I can get into, I think, what was going on in his head, why he did this. But this idea of a third, he caught on to this, too. But because he was a Unitarian, I don't think he quite got it. Christ, a part of the Godhead, mm-hmm. would be one third of the Godhead.
Sure.
And while he was on the cross, he literally bankrupted heaven at that point, becoming all sin, and actually saying in the Psalms, my God, why have you forsaken me? He knew why. He just was repeating the Psalms, what David had actually said.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, when he was all sin, literally all sin, the Spirit, the Father, they couldn't dwell with that. This idea of actually being with this corruption, it was impossible. That's what Christ was taking it on, totally alone. Mm-hmm. And then he does, of course, and he's raised to this high glory. He's still part of the Trinity through that whole thing. But there was some weird supernatural thing that was going on at that point. I mean, and the sun went dark, and I mean, there's a huge earthquake. It really was an amazing moment at the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
But that illuminates, that illustrates really clearly this idea of a fraction of the third of the whole, and 100% of something is a whole. One third of 100% is 33,
mm-hmm.
and finding Christ's death at 33 and a third, you start wondering maybe that has something to do with the rest of his body's resurrection, and that's where things start getting interesting, because if you look at the center of Jerusalem itself, you can see the Unger's Bible Handbook. I think it was written almost 100 years ago. And I discovered this after I discovered it again, that the Mediterranean is a perfect 33 and a third away in statute miles from Jerusalem, especially the temple. Temple Mount, 33 and a third. And when I measured the azimuth of this angle where it touches at 33 and a third, that's the shortest distance you can go to from the Temple Mount to the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
It's at an angle of 19.47 degrees from from the west to the north. This is west-north. So you see that repeated again. You also see when Christ first rose from the dead, the first thing he told Mary, I believe, was, mm-hmm. tell the disciples I will meet them in Galilee. Well, Galilee itself, the word Gal in Hebrew means a circuit. It's spelled with two letters, Gimel mm-hmm. and Lamed. And Gimel is the third letter, and Lamed equals 30, and Gimel equals 3, so it's 33. Those letters equal 33.
And it's on the 33rd parallel.
And it's on the 33rd parallel.
Okay. Huh.
And so you see these things over repeated over and over again. So what's this thing with 33? Well, there's a connection with Christ and his resurrection, the resurrection of his body. If you look at navigation, if you look at time itself, the way it's all arranged, this just fits into this whole theory that Newton was looking at when it comes to the temple. You can see that a third of an hour, for example, will stand out with these motifs, 1947, 33, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to have 33% of an hour, if you look at your clock, the minute hand, in a digital clock, you'll see it has 59 seconds, mm-hmm. 59 minutes, and then it turns over to the next hour. So you never see more than 59 seconds. So whenever you're measuring in navigation, you know, you have your degrees and minutes and seconds, you're always using 59 minutes to calibrate how many minutes you have in your hour. So to figure out how many minutes a perfect third of an hour is, you take 59 times 0.33. That gives you 90 minutes, 47 seconds.
Okay.
But, well, the weird thing is, when did the rebirth of Israel occur?
Well,
1947 years after 81. AD, I mean, you know, 1 AD.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at the number again for the rebirth of something or the birth of something close to at least what the actual Gregorian calendar says is the birth of Christ. So you're actually hooking those things together, the birth of Christ, the rebirth of Israel, and the number of that idea of the third, 19.47. You just extend, you take the decimal place out and put it at the end, 1947,
mm-hmm.
add it to 1 AD, you get 1948. You start looking at other things too, like, okay, well, if Christ started his ministry in 30 AD, what if there's a connection of a third somehow to the beginning of the Antichrist ministry? I mean, this is really speculative, but mm-hmm. I started looking at this whole idea. If you're looking at a third of an hour being 19 minutes, 47 seconds, in decimal, it's 19 minutes, 0.79. So it's 19.79 minutes.
Okay.
Let's leave it seconds out.
Mm-hmm.
So by adding 19.79, taking the decimal place out and putting it into a year, so it's 1979 years, you add that to 30 AD, you end up in 2009 AD. You add mm-hmm. it to 33 AD, you end up at 2012. And what's amazing is if you take 33 hours and 33 minutes and you count all the minutes together, there was 2012 minutes altogether.
Okay.
So there's this consistency to the idea that 2012 would fit this motif. Moreover, there's other connections too that are directly connected to the temple. And I found that when it comes to like the duration of when the temple was first built, the first dedication of the temple, all the way till where you end up in the year 2015. And I'll have to look closer because I didn't write that down. It was at the very end of the book. But it actually is a parenthetical sort of view of the duration of the temple based on these universal constants, mathematics. And it actually takes into account the actual date of Solomon's temple's its dedication, which it's debated, you know, how many years, you know, forward or backwards in times that actually happened. But 960 seems to be that consistent year. I found that all the events in the temple from 960 forward in time fit a strange pattern of redundancy. You actually see numbers repeated, 333, 444. You'd see the number 7 shows up over and over again. In fact, from the distance of time from the destruction of the first temple in 586 BC to the second temple in 70 AD, you have the number again that actually fits into 7 times 360, 2,520. And the way that's figured out is those numbers reappear again when it comes to the rebirth of Israel and the fall of Babylon. I put them all in the book. They all fit the consistent theme that Newton was looking at, but never quite found. It fits the sacred cubit exactly. That's why the sacred cubit is so important. You can actually see demonstration of the sacred cubit even with the fall of Jericho, where they circle Jericho 6 times, and then on the 7th time, they circled it 7 times and blew their horns and their trumpets, and then the walls fell. Well, you know, 7 times 360 is 2,520.
Okay.
On the other hand, though, you can find other examples of things that in England. England has the highest incident, and this, it gets into a strange realm where most people may have trouble with, the idea of crop circles showing mostly in England and mostly in a place called Wiltshire.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wonder, if this is a bona fide supernatural phenomenon, why are they all showing up here? And why crop circles? I mean, it's a really strange thing.
Mm-hmm.
Until you find out that the very first temple was built on a threshing floor that was bought by King David from a guy who's a Jebusite, which actually means to thresh grain, the Jebusites did. And it was a circular threshing floor where you would lay grain stalks and you would have an animal tread over them and literally make a crop circle.
Wow. Okay.
And so if you actually extend a line from the Temple Mount where this threshing floor is to where all these crop circles are occurring, it's at a swath across Wiltshire in England that's from 33 degrees to 33.33 degrees away from the Temple of Jerusalem.
You mean across the globe of the earth?
Yeah.
33, a third of the distance across the earth.
Yeah, and you end in the perfect swath where the concentration of these crop circles occur. And also, they began in earnest from 1979 and 1978 and 1980
mm-hmm.
forward, and increasing in intensity since then, which is interesting because if you go only 33 degrees over the Earth, that's 1,979 miles. And if you go 33 and a third degrees, I'm sorry, over the Earth, you'll have 2,012 nautical miles. So what it's saying then is if you're looking in respect to the Temple of Jerusalem, you're seeing these crop circles speaking a symbolic, esoteric statement about the temple itself and about a future that's connected to 33. And some of those crop circles have actually appeared at the distance, the date that equals the distance from the Temple Mount. Also, the greatest megalithic site in England, I guess, is Avebury Circle.
Right, uh-huh.
It's a huge thing. And it's placed absolutely perfectly on 51 degrees north latitude, 51 point, gosh, it's like maybe in decimal 0.47 something. But that number is exactly what you get if you take 360 and divide it by 7, the latitude that Avebury Circle is placed on.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, 7 times 360 is 2,520. So in a way, whoever put Avebury Circle there is stamping a memorial of this idea of this importance of the number 360 and the number 7, and of course 2,520.
Which again is that sacred cubit dimension.
Right.
Okay.
So if you measure your distances from that point, you actually end up finding a consistency of numbers. You find that it's 207 nautical miles away from Jerusalem. In my book, I put why that has a lot to do with it. You end up with, the number 7 again, and you can make twice 7. There's way more to it that I have even been able to.
Well, I know, and we're really running out of time, and I don't want to get, give away too much in the course of the interview, because I certainly want people and recommend your book to people so that they can dig into this and see the amazing connections that you've made, and also see the documentation and your logic behind using the numbers that you've selected for coming up with these calculations, so that they're not – because there are other people on the internet, frankly, who have tried to do this, and they just pull numbers at random in order to make connections where none exist. And I will repeat again, as someone who thinks that my wife is the smartest person I know, she doesn't impress easily, and she – like I said, David, is convinced that you may have unlocked the key here to a real-life riddle that is far greater than what Dan Brown concocted for the Da Vinci Code because, again, this all points back to Christ and him crucified, to borrow a phrase from the Apostle Paul. Just a couple things I want to touch on very quickly in the last, say, 7 or 8 minutes here. This was the title of the article that headlined at WorldNet Daily today, Monday, August 18th of 2008. Has temple author discovered location of the lost Ark of the Covenant? How does the temple at the center of time point to possibly the location of the lost Ark of the Covenant?
Well, I talk about a lot, and Newton talks about a lot, the number, the sacred cubit. And I started thinking, well, what do we know about the Ark? I mean, the Ark is a centerpiece to the temple. It was it was the oracle to the temple. It's what Newton focused on. The whole idea of the temple was to house this thing. And this was where God, from eternity, touched our point in space and time, and the space-time continuum. That's where it was all happening. And so that object, if it was destroyed, it really doesn't make that much sense. That something that amazing and marvelous would be destroyed. And I started looking at the history, and I found some incredible inconsistencies with books that have been incredibly popular, theories about where the Ark is. Graham Hancock signing the seal saying that the Ark's down in Axum, Ethiopia. Well, okay, but it probably isn't, because Josiah, 300 years after this story of how Solomon and the Queen of Sheba had a son, and Menelik took the Ark there before Shishak and exacted tribute from the temple treasury. That was 300 years later. Josiah says, put the Ark back in the temple. Stop walking around with it, you Levites. So that writes that out completely, that theory. The other theory of it being under the temple, the Knights Templar, that was their greatest goal, to recover the Ark. They had almost 200 years to look for it. I mean, I could dig a really big hole in 200 years, even with a little trowel. I don't think they really missed anything under the Temple Mount. But there's theories that that's where it is. There's other theories that it's under Golgotha, which doesn't fit much historical records whatsoever. But there is only one Bible reference that was actually accepted in the Western canon, and even in the King James Version, until 1851. And that is 2 Maccabees. It's the second chapter, and it's the third and fourth verse, where it says, before the Babylonians came and destroyed the temple in 586 BC, Jeremiah hid it in Mount Nebo. That's the only story in the Western canon, and it's repeated in a couple other books, in the apocryphal book of Baruch, and in the Talmud and places. That's the only reference to where it was put and who did it, Jeremiah. There's actually a story in Baruch that says that Jeremiah threw the keys to the temple to the east, and Mount Nebo is perfectly to the east of the temple.
Okay.
You can actually sight it through the gate, the eastern gate.
How far away from Jerusalem is it?
25.20 nautical miles.
You're kidding.
No, and it's exactly at that latitude of where the eastern gate goes, and right where the Dome of the Spirits, or Dome of the Tablets, where I believe the actual Ark of the Covenant was over.
Now,
so what I think happened was Jeremiah was saying, I'm going to hide this thing in the one place which would be closest to keeping it near and dear to the temple itself. So it's exactly at the same latitude, and it's at a distance which repeats the number of the sacred cubit, and it's at the place where Moses supposedly ascended, or he was taken up, and you look in the book of Judah, says he was taken up by Michael, but where he died and his body was lost, Mount Nebo, where he saw all the nation of Israel and wasn't allowed to go into it. That one place is where Jeremiah is said to have put the Ark. And you can And I'm a little bit worried about, you know, this information getting out, because, I mean, it really looks viable to me. You have an altitude of where this actual location is, 1,260 feet above sea level. That's half.
2,520. Okay.
Exactly. And that one number, 1,260, is Solomon's name in Greek. It equals that. Solomon, the first builder of the temple. And then if you go to the Temple Mount itself, it's 2,520 feet at its highest point.
Oh, boy.
So you have the numbers intact redundantly. And even the idea of navigation comes from a word that actually means, in the Greek, the holy of holies, the naos. The word navigation and nautical, those ideas, those words in Latin stem from the Greek word naos, which was used literally in the New Testament for the oracle place, the place of the holy of holies.
And I don't mean to cut you off here, but I'm going to put a link to this article at WorldNet Daily so people can look this up themselves and get a taste of what kind of work you've done in Temple in the Center of Time. But just very quickly here, David, because I again, don't want to tie you up for the whole evening, just another minute or two. One of the criticisms we've heard already is that you're engaging in numerology and an unbiblical, unscriptural use of numbers to try to foretell or prognosticate the future. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think numerology is trying is an idolatry. It's this idea of trying to predict the future not with God. What I'm doing is I'm pulling it out of Scripture. I'm looking at the numbers that are intact, and if you could read the Hebrew, it would stand right in your face. And so there's actually Jewish sages that say when the Messiah comes, and they were leaving, you know, not Jesus, but when the Messiah comes, he will teach us the meaning of Scripture. And not only that, he'll teach us every word, and then he'll teach us all the letters and all the numbers of the letters, and then all the spaces between those letters. And so what he's basically saying is there is a mathematical depth to infinite depth to the Word of God, and numbers have been looked at, biblical numerics have been a reputable and valid science for like 100 years. You can find biblical numerics by Bollinger and works by Seiss and works by James Strong, and then people don't have any problem at all going through and using their resources from 100 years ago. And they had no problems at all looking at the biblical relevance of numbers and how they actually state the same thing in forward text. You know, they speak about grace, that you see the repetition of the number 5 for grace. You see the number 888 in association with Jesus Christ. You can actually find, you know, in the Bible code now, those sort of numbers show up again, too, in the equal letter sequences. So it's a reputable science. It's not profane. It's not used to prognosticate anything except the prophecies that they're attending to. And the Temple of Jerusalem is the center of all of it. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with that argument, because it's pretty easy to, you know, bring up some pretty reputable, outstanding people from the past and say, well, they're doing the same thing as I am. I'm just kind of standing on their shoulders right now.
Mm-hmm. Well spoken and well said. And it is a magnum opus. Again, Sharon gave it a 5-star review, and I look forward to getting through the rest of it. But like I said, she's already been through it 3 times, and that's not something she normally does. Temple at the Center of Time, Newton's Bible Codex, finally deciphered in the year 2012 by David Flynn. You can pre-order it now at Amazon.com. It will be out in print very soon. We understand from Tom Horn it is supposed to be out from the printer this week and already in the top 50 in the rankings at Amazon.com. Look forward to you've got forthcoming interviews at Coast to Coast AM and other places, do you not?
Well, I don't know about the Coast to Coast interview yet, but I'm supposed to talk to Steve Quayle tomorrow, and I'll let you know if I do get on Coast to Coast. That would be good.
Yeah, it would be.
They have a lot of listeners.
Yeah, a couple. Probably a few more than this podcast, and that's why we're really honored and delighted to have you take some time out of your schedule to talk with us again tonight.
My pleasure. I'll talk to you anytime you want.
Wonderful. Special PID radio broadcast again. Sorry that Sharon couldn't be with us tonight because of a feeling a bit under the weather, but we'll put links to all of the articles that we've talked about tonight, and of course a link to where you can find Temple at the Center of Time. It's an amazing work, David, and the recognition that's coming your way here is deserved not only because of your hard work, but because it does point to Christ and Him crucified, and that is the key.
Yeah, that's exactly where I hope I end in most people's minds if they read the book. And that's exactly the point.
David Flynn, the book Temple at the Center of Time, Newton's Bible Codex, finally deciphered in the year 2012. Pre-order yours now. I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless you.
Cutting-edge news and analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.